This is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about lizard folk or lizard men in D&D from their earliest days as faceless wilderness threats to complex cultures with alien worldviews. How has D&D's portrayal of these scaled humanoids evolved? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into it, as always, I'll remind everyone at the end of the show is the After Party Chat. That is a live video chat hosted by Dan and I. It is open to all of our patrons, and so you can join in by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier and get your accounts all set up. You should get an invite to our Discord server where we host the chat. And around 10 minutes after the show, we will be there to chat with you all.
Definitely. We love that part of our week. Thanks to all our patrons and, for example, Bacrius for checking in that we're currently live on YouTube and Twitch and Restream. So helpful to check in on that. Thank you. Paul, you suggested that lizard men is a topic, and it certainly wasn't on my radar. I'm glad you suggested it. Was there any particular motivation that
They just seem to keep popping up for me recently. You know, most recently, of course, when you and I were at Rising Phoenix Game Con, you role-played as a group of lizard men. They're featured in our most recent dungeon design dash. They're not the major elements, but they are, interestingly, in that dungeon, they're the really only potential social encounter, right? They're the only group of monsters you're really going to maybe have a conversation with.
Yes.
So
That
I thought was interesting.
Right. Welcome to.
And then I don't know. I think they were coming up. There's other adventures that I was reading or reviewing and thinking about them. And they're fascinating because, you know, I don't know that they're quite listed as like a trademark Wizards of the Coast monster.
Yeah.
But also tracing their precedence in or their origin is difficult. And I didn't find a lot when I was researching this into like where they might have come from. How did they make their way into D&D in the first
place? I agree with that. They you know, as we know, they show up in the first supplement. So they show up in the Greyhawk supplement less than a year after original D&D was published. They're almost like one of the very first things that's not from classic mythology. They don't have a completely clear direct pulp precedent, although it's a lot of like, you know, reptilian type something humanoids and Howard and H.P. Lovecraft, and Howard has serpent men and things like that. So it's kind of in the ballpark. And I agree that they're almost the first thing that you could almost point to and say could have been. It could have been kind of the first classic TSR invented IP monster, potentially. And I was somewhat surprised to realize that myself this weekend.
Yeah, and they've occupied an interesting place in the sort of greater ecology of D&D monsters, if you will. I'm going to put up a message here from William in the chat, who says, I feel like lizard men slash folk always seem to pop up as neutral monsters for the PCs to potentially interact with. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about them for me, why I started really digging into them, is I was starting to question, you know, how much are they a monster versus just maybe a misunderstood race of creatures or whatnot. I think it's interesting. I'm gonna jump right away to that first text description of what we see from them in Greyhawk.
Yeah.
They don't appear in OD&D, right? They show up in supplement to their Greyhawk. And here's the description. Lizard men, and I've highlighted a section here, and it tells us they are fond of human flesh and they will generally capture as many humans as they can when offered the opportunity in order to make them, I'm sorry, in order to take them to their lair and have a tribal feast. That's like half the text of the description of lizard men is how they eat
people. Yeah.
Correct. That's pretty gruesome. That's pretty monstrous, I would say.
Totally, that's right?
Like
totally.
An attack on sight kind of creature, I think.
And I don't think, and so again, original three sentences is all you get. This is not uncommon for monsters at the time. You get three sentences. Elsewhere, there's a stat block. They get a claw bite attack routine. They are listed as neutral. Now, this is only three alignments at this time still. So your options are either lawful, neutral, chaotic, and they are listed as being in that central thing. The other interesting, the thing that is, traditional here, that the only other sentences that you didn't read there, Paul, are that they're aquatic monsters. Mm-hmm. They have a root intelligence. They use some simple weapons like spears and clubs. And then the last sentence again reiterates they live either wholly underwater or in very wet places. And I agree. So I think that my take on what you highlighted there, Paul, is that, at the time we didn't have a lot of subtlety in D&D. There weren't creatures really being written, I think, with the intent of we're going to have complex interrelationships and complex negotiations. It's pretty stark, either they're enemies or they're supporters. And I almost feel like it's almost half accidental that they got listed as neutral, maybe just for variety, that not every single monster gets put into the chaotic category, and that was an opportunity for invention later on of kind of spiraling off, like, well, what is it about them that makes them neutral, or how does that make them interesting? And I totally agree with William that that has been like a real treasure, actually, that we could play, that they gave us flexibility to possibly play in a bunch of different directions, despite the fact they were clearly man-eating threats as written in the text.
I think that what's very interesting here to me that I think that possibly spins D&D in this direction, right, is, first of all, it says right here that they are, right, that they have a rude intelligence, right? They are always depicted as being somewhat primitive. They have crude weapons, right? But they are humanoid. They are presumably capable of speech, I guess. I don't know. Is how quickly do we see lizard man as a language? Is it right here in OD&D? I'm not sure.
That's never clear in OD&D. That's never actually spelled out in first edition. Is the first time you get actually a comprehensive list of languages, and lizard men are definitely in there.
But you definitely get
my take. Okay.
Let me finish my thought. Which is simply that there's plenty of monsters in D&D that are just above humans on the food chain. And that's not necessarily, it's not like they're evil, right? They're not cannibals. They don't eat each other. They eat people. And that's fine and normal. And there's nothing inherently good or evil about them. But I feel like lizard men are perhaps portrayed in this way. They kind of ride this line because they are a society, right? They live in some kind of tribe or something. There's groups of them. Mm-hmm. They coordinate efforts. They're humanoid, right? They're riding that line of like, well, we can't call them cannibals, but it's not great that they eat people, right?
Right. Clearly set up to be threats to people, but not distinctly evil.
Right. I feel like that's where that neutrality comes into play, right? They just are higher than us on the food chain, and we are tasty to them, and so be it.
Yeah, it's almost, you almost get like a Marvel Galactus thing of like, I don't have ill will towards you. I'm just driven by hunger. I'm a force of nature kind of thing. Like you can't morally despise me for that. I'm just trying to survive. It's interesting that in first edition, in the D&D's and Deities and Demigods book, they have a lizard man dedicated deity called Semuanya, if I recall correctly. And the text there is just totally devoted to survival of the race. Just we prefer not to interact with other creature types and just defend ourselves, survive, propagate the race, be very coldly analytical towards that. That's the ethos of the lizard men deity as a first edition, which is an interesting, which again gives kind of an interesting different texture from the standard sinister ravening take over the world, destroy humanity type things. I mean, I don't think lizard men would want to destroy humanity, because then where would you get your feast from? So I feel like there's almost a potential synergy there. It's like we don't hate people, we love them, particularly with like a little butter sauce. That's really the best way.
I want to jump forward to the AD&D monster manual description, Dan. But you I cut you off. You said you had a take. Is there something you want to get in here before I jump?
Well, you know, actually, could you pull up the cover of the supplement, the first supplement where they show up? So back in 1970 episode. So here's your Greyhawk supplement where they first appear. You know, it's this supplement is labeled as by Gary Gygax and Rob Kuntz. They don't specifically have names on individual monsters, so probably one or the other of them came up with it. And the other thing that I forgot is that as soon as this monster was invented, look at the bottom, look at the very bottom of the cover of this book, it immediately became the logo of the company. I actually kind of forgot about that, but when I personally got into D&D, the logo of the company making D&D, namely TSR, was this lizard man at the bottom of the book. And that from 1975 to 1978, that was the representation of the company making D&D, not a dragon, not a wizard, not the initials, but actually this creature type. So it seemed very, you know, foundational and very fundamental in a lot of ways at the time. And I was kind of glad to be reminded of the fact.
I mean, I completely agree with that. And the other piece of artwork that jumps out to me as we move forward is, of course, the front cover of the Player's Handbook, right? Which I'm pretty sure there's lizard men, right? I think they look like lizard men to me.
I agree.
Yeah, so clearly there's a strong attachment to them as a monster type in the company at this time period, which is fascinating.
I agree.
Let me jump forward here to the monster manual, or back, I guess, from Player's Handbook to the monster manual entry. Again, this artwork, this will always be the classic image of a lizard man to me. I adore this artwork so much.
Dave Trampier, I love it.
Yep. Also did the cover of the Player's Handbook there. So I've highlighted again where they've doubled down on this fact about lizard men, where it tells us they're omnivorous, but lizard men are likely to prefer human flesh to other foods. In this regard, they have been known to ambush humans, gather up the corpses and survivors as captives, and take the lot back to their lair for a rude and horrid feast. A little more editorial here, Dan, about
about a little more graphic
eating habits of lizard men.
Yeah, expansion.
And to your point, like now they're only semi-aquatic as opposed to being aquatic, but still like very very high to water, right? Found in swamps and marshes. Here we're starting to see they band together in tribal form, right? So there's clearly tribes of them.
Yeah.
They must have a language, a society, a something, etc. So they're not, you know, what do we have for their intelligence here? Low? Yeah. They're primitive, but they're, I don't know. And the reason I pick on all this is because I feel like, to go back to William's initial comment, I feel like over time, we do see them morph more and more into this neutral territory where they might be good or might be bad or probably just independent, trying to survive, nothing to do with the players. I feel like it goes so hard in that direction. I feel like that these days, most of us associate them with that kind of depiction.
Yeah, there's clearly this gravity that was sucking them. It's just so useful. It's just so useful to the DM to be have yeah. something that's flexible. It's a threat, but not necessarily. Maybe we can find common ground. Maybe not. Maybe we can negotiate. Maybe they're just a threat in this case. And so having that, you know, this element of risk reward that's a little bit ambiguous is really just so useful for the DM in so many different ways. You can kind of see why it was almost an unavoidable opportunity to play out that. You know, you're making me realize with the semi-aquatic bit that on the first line of what we're looking at, the percentage of them dwelling above or underwater flipped. So in OD&D, it was 35% that they would live not underwater. And here it's now 35% that they are totally underwater. So it actually flipped from 2-to-1 odds that they'd be underwater where you can't access them to 2-to-1 odds that they'd be above water where you might more likely interact with them. And I didn't notice that until this very second. Yeah, they get a little bit less wet over time. They dry out a bit over time. Okay, yeah. Now I got to point out one weird thing about the monster manual that's one of these things that's a little bit of a proud nail for me. Here's a question that I pose to the group. Do lizard men use swords?
Oh, excellent question, right? Because of course in the earlier text we saw that they used spears and clubs and crude weapons. Mm-hmm. Yet clearly in this picture he's holding a sword.
Which is wildly in contradiction with the text, because the text here at the bottom actually drives even harder into the fact that they're primitive and usually don't have tools. So there's a rule there that says 90%, 9 in 10 groups of lizard men don't have any tool usage whatsoever, and they're just going to attack you with their raw, their natural claw bite. 1 in 10 has evolved to a higher state, and they might use crude shields and darts and javelins. And then in melee, they would use clubs. Now, even the more advanced 1 in 10 type doesn't have swords or anything like that. But this is one of these cases where Trampier made this wonderful piece of art, and it tends to stick in our head a lot harder than what the text says, which says they only have clubs, actually. It's and the other thing is that mechanically, they're better off using their natural attacks, actually does better damage than any weapon that they might have. And that's kind of an oversight in my mind.
There's an interesting contradiction here, right? Because historically, right, as humans evolved, we started using tools, we started using weapons, we started getting things like clubs and spears and javelins. And those obviously greatly improved the deadliness of a relatively soft human form. But when you then try to translate that into a creature like a lizard man who has claws and teeth, and you're trying to create game statistics for that, like, it becomes this, right, thematically, we want them to appear to be, primitive, so we, give them the same kinds of weapons humans had as primitive humans, but those are actually worse statistically than their natural claws and teeth, which is weird. Yeah.
you might say that this is another argument against the trope of claw bite routines that came up in the first supplement, right? Original D&D didn't have that. The first supplement was like, oh, we're going to give you a wild variety of attacks and damage for your monsters. And once again, giving them the 3 claw bite almost inevitably makes that mechanically better than weapons. And that mistake kind of happens over and over again. This is one example of it. So for me, I'm like, well, if I was playing OD&D and they only had 1 attack and it only ever did D6, then I could play around with some other weapon type that would be better.
All right, I want to dig into...
I got 2 other things about first edition when you have an opportunity, Paul.
Go ahead. I was going to move on, so go ahead. Wait.
Okay. Possibly a couple of places where you didn't think to look. The DM's Guide has a section on non-human spellcasters, and lizard men are listed there. Is they have the opportunity to be shaman, and they get the top level of capacity. So again, there's a place where lizard men are developed in a way they actually have the highest spellcasting opportunities as shaman in first edition D&D, along with giant types. So they actually come in at the top level there. And the other interesting thing that happens historically is that in the Fiend Folio, and I have an illustration of this, they have like a special type of Lizardmen called the Lizard King, which is listed in a separate stat block. There you go. So here we are. I think it's 1982. In the Fiend Folio, you get the Lizard King. Significantly more powerful. They have kind of a special trident attack. They like have four times the hit dice. And one of the interesting things here is that the alignment of the Lizard King is specifically given as chaotic evil.
Interesting.
So now, the leader type,
I admit I don't know Fiend Folio super well. It's not something that's solidly in my brain, but it jumped out at me that you said 1982 because I was about to start looking at modules. Where do lizard men appear in modules? How are they portrayed?
Yeah.
And of course, one of the big ones will be 1982's I2 Tomb of the Lizard King. So are we just riffing off of the appearance of a specific custom named monster that appeared in a module? And
I think so, right?
Is that what's happening here? Because certainly the main villain of Tomb of the Lizard King, Chaotic Evil, is probably the right choice.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed on that.
Of course, he's way worse, I think, statistically, than what we're describing here, right? He's the Lizard King is a ninth-level caster, and
Can I spoil it? Right. So spoiler alert, but DMs feel free to use this, so... In Mark Aker's module, Tomb of the Lizard King, which has the code I2, and I'm trying to... 1982, same year. That's interesting. So maybe these were being developed at the same time. The final boss in Tomb of the Lizard King is a Lizard King wizard vampire. Lizard King wizard vampire. So that's a bad day. That's a pretty bad day for your character levels 5 to 7 when they run into that that boss at the end of that module.
I'm disappointed that they co-opted that and shoved him into a generic type in a book like this, because I do feel like I2's Lizard King is a very specific character, right? He wasn't even bitten by a vampire. He had a ring of wishes. He made an ill-advised wish. Right, like it's a very I personally adore that. I love adventures that go out of their way to be like, no, I'm inventing something hyper custom. This is a specific individual, not just a new type of monster. So I'm almost a little disappointed by this. Assuming this is an adaptation of that, which I don't know. It seems circumstantial. Maybe this is an adaptation of the Tomb of the Lizard King, or maybe that's just two people you haven't used the same name.
I thought the other direction. That seems like a pretty good argument to sign. And you know what, Paul? I agree that this is this kind of thing, and they still do it today, is arguably filler in your new books. Of did you really have to give the DMs like a quarter page of how you can bulk up a lizard man if you want to? That could just be a couple lines, and you're like, just add some more hit points or add a character class if you want to. Go and make a lizard man wizard or cleric. That's not too hard. So I agree that those kinds of tiny specialization of certain monsters, you don't really need a separate stat block for an aquatic ogre, and you really don't need a separate stat block for leaders of lizard men. So I don't disagree. It's interesting that this became sticky in the lore, and lizard men leaders tend to be called lizard kings. Even still today in 2024, D&D.
Interesting. Yeah. So other appearances, early appearances of lizard men, as I was hunting for them in earlier modules. We see them in X1 in 1981. Again, there's a tribe of them. They're not central to the plot. They're there. They're present. But the other big one that jumped out at me, same year as Tomb of the Lizard King. Now, Tomb of the Lizard King, clearly evil, horrible army of lizard men that must be stopped, right? Like they are bad villains in the adventure. At the same time, in the same year, 1982, you have the Danger at Dunwater, the U2, right? The second in that series, which featured lizard men. I think they were in the first one as well, right? In U1. But in U2, certainly they're there. And I cut out a little chunk of text that I want to read because it's just so fascinating to me. Here's in the introduction of U2, under special notes, it tells us the Dungeon Master must on no account reveal to the party that the lizard men constitute no real threat to Salt Marsh or its inhabitants. No real threat.
I think that's a different image than we currently have up. I would like to. This oh, sounds sorry. Interesting, and I would I'm like sorry. To see the, yep. that
there,
quote.
There it is. Sorry, looks very similar. similar yep. wide block of text. There you go. Yep. Lizardmen constitute no real threat to Salt Marsh or its inhabitants. I guess they don't.
The use one. Not, you know, at this time. So the interesting thing is that, you know, the U2 adventure is entirely a Lizardmen complex. The whole thing is you have to go intrude, I'll say, on a Lizardmen complex. So if any players, like, you know, want to grab something that provides a complete comprehensive Lizardmen community, you can go grab U2, and the whole thing lays out what a Lizardmen community looks like in first edition AD&D. And it is this interesting twist that the adventure is basically a red herring. You've been led to believe that the Lizardmen community is arming themselves. This seems like a threat. And again, as a spoiler, at the end of the day, it turns out that they're actually trying to defend themselves against an even worse threat that you need to confront in the third module. So it's, and this would happen, you know, this is a common trick that TSR Adventures would use at the time. And in fact, in my Star Frontiers game, I just rewrote them doing the same kind of thing of you invade a group that ultimately you need to negotiate and become allies with. And it's a little bit awkward about, like, if the players go whole hog and just start murdering large numbers, is it really reasonable that they're going to become allies at the end of it? And how do you play that? But that actually is how the Danger at Dunwater is set up. If you go in, hopefully you're investigating mostly, and you find out that there's a worse threat that you could possibly ally yourselves with the Lizardmen for mutual survival. And that's the point of that adventure.
Yeah. And I feel like this starts the precedent of using Lizardmen specifically for this purpose, right? That they are potentially a threat or potentially can be negotiated with, not sure. The party can go either way. This leads right into the classic example that I always think of. My first real exposure to both that trope and to Lizardmen is, of course, 1988's Pool of Radiance. I don't know if you remember this particular encounter, Dan, but sure enough, there's a little it's a very short bit in the game where you're told there's a group of lizard men and they're going to join Tyranthraxus's army and we have to eradicate them so that they're not part of the invading force. Please go eradicate the lizard men. And you go up to their village where they're hanging out. And you could run in there and you could storm the castle and just kill them all. That is an option. But there is also a weird subplot where it turns out that there's some two entities that are vying for power over the Lizardman community, and you can help them. You can join one side if you want, be their champion, shut down the more aggressive side of the tribe. And if you do so, then you kind of engage with peace with the Lizardmen, and they promise not to join Tyranthrax's army, and you've neutralized the threat by simple negotiation. And
I'm so glad you remind me of that, because that's exactly the setup in Dunwater, actually, is that the Lizardman community has two factions that are somewhat in debate, and I don't know, if you accidentally terminate the better side, then you're only left with the more aggressive side. So don't try not to do that. So it's almost exactly the same setup, like within the community itself. That's fascinating. That's a good reminder. I got one other example, right? Keep on the Borderlands, right? Module B2 in the basic set, almost certainly the most widely played D&D adventure of all time. The first wilderness encounter is Lizardmen, right? Written by Gary Gygax, and the very first any kind of monster in the book is Lizardmen. There's a Lizardmen mound, so potentially for a lot of classic D&D players, that might have been the first monster encounter they ever ran into. And of course, our friend Max not long ago was running brand new players through Keep on the Borderlands, and they stumble into this lizard mound, TPK. Wipe out all the players in their very first encounter, and they came away going, I didn't realize that was a possibility in this game. I didn't know that could happen. And Max was like, yes, that can happen. And so they made, you know, to their credit, they made up new characters and like, we're going to play better. we're not going to send all the wizards alone into the lizard men mound next time. After that kind of tough lesson, they played a lot better. Thank you, lizard men.
That's great. One of the things that I found confusing about the lizard men in trying to research them is that there's just a lot of variation of lizard men and things that are adjacent to lizard men or not quite lizard men, right? Because like the birthday game, our first streamed show, right? I believe there was a lizard, I just pulled it up. I was trying to get in front of my face while I talked about it. There's somebody in this called the Lizard King. That's a character. That's a major NPC villain called quote unquote the Lizard King. Now he's not a lizard man. Mm-hmm. He's a troglodyte, and he rules over a group of troglodytes, which apparently troglodytes don't fall into this category. I don't see a lot of adventures about, you know, troglodytes being neutral and maybe cool, and maybe, I guess, just because they have terrible body odor, we're okay with them just being absolute villains. The Yuan-Ti, I feel like, I when I was trying to research this topic, I ran headfirst into a lot of snake men, or that lead us into the Yuan-Ti direction, which is not quite lizard men. Also weird and nebulous, and, you know, especially because they're often presented as maybe sometimes being able to pass for human. And so then it gets, you know, extra confusing about the morality of them. But I don't know, snake men, troglodytes. What do you think? Are we all cutting from the same cloth here? Or are these like really truly unique creatures?
It's a good question. Similarly, like with watery kind of non-human opponents, you know, obviously H.P. Lovecraft had the deep ones. And then, D&D has the Sahuagin, which are arguably just renamed Deep Ones, possibly. And they're the first monster type that have an enormous backstory written for them, has multiple pages in the Blackmoor supplement when they first show up, which kind of points the way to having these complex cultures. But those types are all clearly labeled as being evil, clearly sinister. You know, troglodytes, just linguistically, right? You know, I mean, troglodytes are clearly a negative. If you say, Sam, that person is a troglodyte, there's nothing positive that you're saying about that. That's clearly a negative thing that you're saying.
Yeah.
So culturally, linguistically, and in the game, they're, you know, you can't possibly negotiate them because you can't even get through how bad they smell, just for starters. So I feel like lizard men are kind of interesting that they provided a different direction from all these other things that are classically serpentine, reptilian, scaly, obviously radically opposed to people. And lizard men come in a slightly different direction, which is kind of refreshing. But there's a lot of them. There's certainly, you're not wrong. That there's certainly a lot of these scaly humanoidy types being turned out.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. Sorry, I was just poking through, like, where does the word troglodyte even come from? And apparently, it's from the ancient Greek of meaning cave dwellers. So they're human, maybe. Yeah. I don't know, Dan. I feel like I'm worried our conversation is going to lead dangerously into the direction of what are the actual human stand-ins that are being represented here. I don't know if you want to touch on this or not, but I have to say that every time I look at the way lizard men are represented, that oftentimes I think we edge into the trope of kind of the noble savage, and possibly they become stand-ins for Native Americans. And I'm not sure that's great.
Okay, I will admit that's not the first thing that pops into my head. You know, let me say this. It's interesting that it's one of the few, like in this category of stuff that's kind of like people, you know, like another thing that I look at is the Swords and Spells book, which was another supplement to OD&D, which is actually the first OD&D book I ever got. Lizard men kind of pop out in a number of times that they can be organized in a troop formation. Not everything can, but they can. They specifically have, they actually have the highest speed in the game due to their swimming speed, as a matter of fact. And then when the terrain description comes up of like, this might block you. If you're a giant, you could probably step over a swamp easily. Of course, lizard men can just swim across any stream or river that they want at any time. So there's kind of a lot of advantages. They're the only non-mammal creature type that falls into this category of you could organize them as a troops. They kind of work like people. They can have spellcasters that are shaman. And so they kind of stand out as interesting. They're non-Tolkienian. They don't show up in Lord of the Rings. They're not mammals. Yep. And so they're one step. I mean, we have a lot of stuff that are allegedly non-human, but as soon as you start playing them in a pseudo player character way, what else do you have to use for role play except stuff from human beings? So there's got to be some kind of, I mean, my take on it would be there's got to be some kind of human culture, tradition, myth, legend, something from people that you use to role play these people-ish things. And so you can say the same thing about dwarves or elves or hobbits or orcs or kobolds or bugbears or whatever. And then lizardmen give you this first step of an opportunity of something that's a little bit more alien. So
yeah.
If that's a critique that could be made about almost any allegedly non-human creature, I think that lizardmen are an opportunity to challenge you to do something a little bit more different.
It's an interesting view on them, right? Because I feel like maybe a decade ago or more, we would have been having this debate about orcs, right? That, you know, how much do you lean into the trope of orcs being just a more warlike community of living creatures that have their own society, right? Are there orc villages, children, etc., or are they more Tolkien-esque, where they are, you know, corrupted elves, where we see in the movie, we see Saruman literally pulling them out of the dirt and the muck and creating them out of corrupt evil magic, right? Right? Do they have a society and thus possibly, you know, are simply misunderstood, or are they pure evil incarnate that must be destroyed in a moment's, you know, the moment you see them? And it's just, it's interesting to me that orcs kind of ride that line, right? Then you have other things like, I don't know, zombies, right? No one ever talks about the morality of zombies. You see a zombie, you kill it, that's it. Right?
Again.
Right? But in the scale of like kind of, right, again, yeah, yeah. But then you have lizardmen, like, and lizardmen, I feel like very early on, like in the early stuff, as we looked at in the beginning, they're horrible monsters that want to eat us. And then very quickly, as early as 82, we start to see them as, they're just misunderstood. They're more complex than that. They live in the gray area. They have their tribes, right? Mm-hmm. So presumably do they lay eggs? Are there baby lizard folk? I don't know. But
so, yeah. You know, if you, okay. And one thing, I guess, okay, as long as we're on this, this point, we should say that Paul and I here are flipping back and forth between calling them lizard folk and lizard men. And be perfectly clear, they were originally called lizard men. Everything you would ever fight would be male, frankly, in the text. So up through zero edition, first edition, second edition, they were lizard men. And then as of third edition in 2000, they were renamed lizard folk to be more general neutral. That makes sense. I understand why they did that. But I still, when we're looking at these, the books are literally going to be saying lizard men and the older stuff. So, you know, one of the awkward things in Keeping the Borderlands and first edition AD&D is that Gary, in the text, absolutely made them all communities that have men and women and young and babies. And that is listed in all the different monster types in Keeping the Borderlands, including the Lizardmen Mound. Absolutely, the Lizardmen Mound, the men come out to fight, and then if you dig into the Lizardmen, what the Lizardmen Mound in B2, what is remaining are some female Lizardmen defending their young. And it's never stated explicitly what the play is expected to be. I expect that it's probably pretty dark. That is how Gary wrote all these different humanoid monster types in early D&D, and it is something that's legitimately really awkward to play through, frankly. Yeah.
Now, interestingly, I will note, like, as we were looking at the Lizardman entry from the Monster Manual, there's no language around. It says that they form into tribes, so you can maybe imply mm-hmm. a bunch of things from that, but it doesn't talk about young and women and their, mm-hmm. like their societal organizations. But the orc section does. The entry on orcs absolutely talks about what their lairs are like and how many men and women and young there will be present. It's fascinating.
All the humanoid types do. So if you look up kobolds, orcs, hobgoblins, goblins, ogres, they all go through that same conversation.
But not lizardmen.
Yeah, but again, you know, you can look at, there's Gary writing it in Keeping the Borderlands, and it's definitely explicit sure. there that that's what's happening.
That's fair.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah. Finish your thought, because I'm going to change the topic a little bit.
I was going to change it as well, because I was going to say, like, and then the way you see this progress is in later editions, right? They start to become playable races, right? That's the progression we start to see.
Okay.
Right? So they get more humanized and more humanized, and now we're just going to have PCs as lizardmen. The most famous lizardman that always comes to my brain, I don't even remember if he's really a lizardman or not, but he kind of falls in this category, is Dragonbait from the Forgotten Realms. I don't know if you know that character, Dan.
Okay.
He's basically a lizardman paladin.
I generally don't follow late era D&D like you're talking about.
If you had played the sequel to Pool of Radiance, Curse of the Azure Bonds, he shows up in that.
Okay, great. So we're totally wanted to talk about the same thing, Paul.
Great.
What I wanted to dig into is like how, I don't know, much we adore lizardmen as potential player characters. And I'll go a little bit earlier on you. Is that the first time I saw an explicit Lizardman player character is in the first edition supplement, The Rogue's Gallery. And that is in 1980. I actually have an image of that. You want to pull up the image? There's some text at top, and then there's an illustration at the bottom.
This one, I think, is what you're referring to.
Yeah. So here's so in the Rogues Gallery, which is most, you know, half of it's just a list of random NPC stats for first edition AD&D. Again, those books were published 77 and 79. This comes out in 1980. Like, you're going to need some NPCs. And then there's this end appendix of, hey, we're going to share some player characters from actual people at TSR in our home games as examples of things you can do in D&D. And there's paladins and there's fighters and there's Mordenkainen and there's Bigby and all these kinds of, you know, big names. And then there's this one character played by Jeff Larson named Phobos, who is explained to be, and he's in the center of that illustration, was a 10th level fighter who died, couldn't find a cleric, and so they reincarnated him and he came back as a lizard man. And he's got top level strength, he's got 1800 strength. And apparently, this is an official publication for Advanced D&D, And apparently you've got this super powerful, interesting highlight. Everybody's, you know, in the illustrations kind of surrounding him. This very unusual character who's a lizard man. And I think a lot of us, you know, landed on this possibility, this illustration, just immediately fell in love with how incredibly cool this character looks. So that was the first time I ran into it. There's one other non-normal character in this list. Dave Cook is listed as having a centaur character. Same story, supposedly. Fighter got to a high level, died, couldn't find a cleric, had to be reincarnated. Now, an interesting point is that in original D&D, it specifically says, you know, you can just play anything you want. The DM, you want to play a dragon? We can do that. That's great. Go do that. In advanced D&D, Gygax clearly regrets that. And the DM's guide, he says, do not let people play anything they want. It's going to break the game and it's going to be terrible. So I suspect, I have this weird suspicion that we might actually be looking at original D&D characters that made use of the go ahead and play anything that you want that might have been a lizard man to begin with. And then in order to justify it under advanced D&D rules, came in and retconned both of these characters as saying, well, they were really human fighters, but then at some point they got reincarnated. But I have this sneaking suspicion that this was actually a lizard man character from the inception. And that was absolutely supported in original D&D on day one in 1974. Why not?
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to me that Gygax, you know, spilled ink over don't allow this to happen. I feel like it was, you know, he's you know, plugging the dam with his finger there, right? Like it's inevitable, I think, that the players were going to demand,
right,
you know, all kinds of crazy stuff. And of course we saw it, right? You know, there was infamously the book that kind of wrecked my campaign was the I think it was like the Complete Book of Humanoids or something, where suddenly players could play all kinds of crazy stuff, including centaurs, which absolutely drove me nuts. Because I was just like, great, all these adventures I have that happen in caves where you have to like climb walls and ladders and, you know, use ropes and such. Not going to work.
Yes.
Good luck with that, buddy.
That's trouble. I agree. And now, likewise, you may know, like, my longest running campaign in D&D was actually a BX campaign. And kind of at the tail end of that, they came out with the rule cyclopedia that compiled all the different BX mensary type rules. And then on the heels of that, they had this series called Creature Crucible, which likewise was like, oh, here's rules. And remember, in that set, race is class, so it's actually somewhat easier to design a completely custom class for one species type. I was very enthusiastic about that, actually. And so I grabbed those rules. And the very first thing that I wrote for my campaign is being a new, non-traditional, non-Tolkien, non-mammal potential player character type was Lizardman. And I did actually write up a whole class listing, you know, basically following those rules of being able to level up through the different Lizardman levels. And then finally terminating, if you become name level, of course, you're known as a Lizard King.
Of course you're a Lizard King.
So I was very warm to that, and I feel like that's, you know, is something that kind of dodges the classic Tolkien tropes and a little bit predictable. You know, it's funny because, partly based on what you were talking about before, Paul, there's a lot of times where I wish that my D&D games only had humans as player characters, and then everything else is fundamentally weird and alien and unexpected. I kind of feel Gygax is, when human beings start playing this other stuff, they inherently become non-alien. So I could almost see, like, do like a Swords and Sandals, you might say, where you just have humans from different backgrounds interacting with this stuff. But on the other hand, if I have to pick up the first next playable character type that is a little bit unusual, I don't mind Lizardmen. I kind of love the prospect, actually.
Interesting. So your talk of that, I was sorry when you were mentioned, my brain is really struggling to connect thoughts for this morning for some reason. when you're talking about Oh gosh, I've done something terrible on my screen. I'm sorry. The desire to like move away from to make everything special, right? To like, I just want to have a human centric, you know, yeah, campaign. Let's get rid of demi-humans and whatnot. I was just recently rereading Jeff Rien's classic post from 2006 of How to Awesome Up Your Players, which includes the quote that I always love, which is always keep the main thing the main thing. But he specifically talks about this. He talks about even for a guy like me who likes robots and lasers in his D&D, sometimes get in a funk of wanting to trim down the character build options. This is going to be all Conan-y with the swords and sorcery. No dummy humans in this campaign. He's like, and he says, I truly deeply understand the profound artistic reason for such an approach. Let me simply say, fuck that shit.
Okay.
That strongly encourages you to move away from that. This is D&D. If you can't fold themes and motifs into a single game starring an elf ninja, a halfling bard, and two ill-tempered gnome wizards, then you should just be writing bad fanfiction. What do you think?
Going to respectfully assess fuck that shit as not a strong argument. Not a strongly reasoned, valid series of logical conclusions. If he had a stronger point, that could have been more clearly made. We love the weird stuff. Yes, we've had weird interactions in our games, but that's if there is a DM that goes in a different direction, I highly respect that.
I think that the thing I feel like he was getting at here is this notion that D&D is itself not really a setting. Right, D&D is an amalgam of settings. It is all the fantasy elements thrown into a big bucket and mixed up with a giant spoon. That's the way I've always looked at D&D, right? Like that quote of D&D is you play Gandalf and I'll be Conan and we'll kill Dracula, right? It's everything all mixed together. So asking your players, hey, we're going to play D&D, but pretend that dwarves and elves don't exist, I feel like that's always going to fall flat. Because, no, I've been playing D&D for decades. I know what elves and dwarves are, man.
I'm gonna make a little bit of a counter argument. If you embrace that, then you are necessarily gonna run up into the cultural appropriation problem.
Mm.
How else are you going to play these kind of humanoid-y things than by borrowing somebody's human culture? So I think that sets up a dilemma of kind of in both directions. Are you
arguing for or against including the? Sorry, I lost the track of your argument here. Yeah. Are you saying that by? It sounded like to me like you were saying that by not having strange races or creature types. I mean, just broaden it. By not having strange creature types, that you therefore must appropriate human cultures? Or the other way around?
Other way around. So if you have allegedly non-human things, you've got to use human traits when you play them, and there's going to be potentially some amount of bad smell about why you're using culture X in playing these horrible troglodytes. Right? Is that a slur against culture X that you're using to play them? And so if you did restrict yourself to just humans, okay, well, they're humans and we're playing them with human cultures. Okay. But the problem of is it sinister to apply culture X traits to orcs, for example, if you've got orcs in the game, that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You can either avoid culture appropriation or you can have a wild variety of non-human creatures, but you can't have both.
Interesting. I feel like we've stumbled into a totally different discussion here, Dan, with barely a few minutes left of this show. So I want to bring us back, Dan, because in fact we're at the end of the show here. Root us in lizard men. What are your thoughts?
Is this our conclusion? Is this our conclusion thoughts?
We're in the last 5 minutes, man. Okay. Last 5 minutes.
Fantastic.
What are your final thoughts on
Luther? I kind of love them, right? And kind of everybody that we've ever known has loved them. I love them. I'm very fond of them. They're my next choice for something that would be a player character. You know, our friend BJ loved Lizardmen. They were his favorite monster too. And he spent gobs of time making these delightful, and I believe he had like a Lizardmen army when he got into Warhammer, and used them a lot in his games as well. So I totally agree that the fact that they were tagged as neutral at the outset made this wonderful opportunity for possibly negotiating, possibly fighting this different, legitimately kind of alien, non-Tolkien type. The fact that it was so such a spectacular idea, it immediately became the logo of the company for D&D. I think really the fact that in 1982 they had multiple adventure modules coming out in Lizardmen strongholds, it's an amazingly fruitful opportunity, amazingly fruitful element in D&D, and that's highly, highly benefited many of our games. And if DMs don't use them a lot now, they should go back and look at all the opportunities that you have to use Lizardmen.
I agree in the general love of them as a creature type in your game. And I do am someone who likes to run games where we're in a sort of moral gray area. I mean, we saw this during during that first birthday game that we live streamed where you had to negotiate with were-rats. I think that was super delightful. And
Totally. Of
course, they double-crossed you at the end, which was great and in character and whatnot. However, I think to play Lizardmen in this way, I suspect you must, as I've always done accidentally, without realizing it until doing research for this show, discard They Eat People. Because if they're eating people, if they are actively hunting people for the tasty nourishment, that really skews things in my mind. That really skews things. I'm very suspicious of that line in U2 of they represent no threat to the local population, except that they want to eat them, right? That's a threat.
It's fascinating that the same year had those two adventures coming out on totally different prongs on the trident, you might say, of one saying they're absolutely no threat and they're your best opportunity to hold off the really bad guys, and the other one a horrible, sinister, eternal vampire, evil, blood-drinking threat to the countryside, right? Simultaneously coming out in both those directions. It's an interesting point, Paul. Now the next time I have Lizardmen, I think I want to dig harder into how can I make it sensible when they do consider humans to be a delicacy.
That is interesting. maybe you even want to now of course as you're saying that now I want to like dig into the like well some do, right? Some Lizardmen tribe
okay.
eat people.
Okay.
Some don't.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And then I want to have the conversation with no, you heard that we eat people. That's not us. That's the other tribe. We don't eat people. I swear.
I've never eaten caviar. I've never eaten frog legs myself. Some people do. If a humanoid frog came up, they should probably, you know, keep their distance. They don't know who I am. I get that. That makes sense.
It's a fair point, Dan. It's a fair point. I suppose equally I should not be surprised if I am hiking in the mountains and get mauled by a mountain lion that it doesn't understand that I'm a vegetarian. Like, come on.
Right?
Leave me alone, man. I'm no threat to you.
I think there's actually a Muhammad Ali quote that I saw not too recently on this point of like, yep, that's you could be, you know, keep yourself safe. Everybody, keep yourself safe out there. We do what you need to do. I'm going to throw up one piece of chat here from John Thomas Kaiser. I'm going to add some lizard men to tonight's game. Perfect, John. Now you're talking. Plus 100 XP to John today.
Yeah.
That's great.
Maybe you should consider adding a remote village of people who eat lizard men.
Okay, that's the win. All right, you win, Paul. That's yeah. That's the win condition. Do that. All right.
Tastes like
that. That's brilliant. That's actually yeah. Okay.
All right, Dan. We're totally out of time. Sorry, viewers. If you have an opinion on the lizard men, lizard folk, how they've appeared across the ages, how you want to see them, should they eat people? Just give me that one. Leave me a comment in the YouTube video and tell me: do you think in D&D lizard men should eat people or not? I want to know.
And while you're doing that, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We, the Wandering DMs, are on YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and TikTok and Loops and GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites, so please look for us there and dunk on that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also, through various third-party podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And, you know, huge thanks to the patrons who support and watch the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to a private Discord server where the conversation continues around the clock. And just like Paul said at the top of the hour, we will be there in about 10 minutes on our Discord server for a live video after chat. And I'm sure our viewers have a lot of other things to remind us about how they have used lizard men that we didn't get in the show here. So we definitely want to hear about that. I think Paul is wandering to other events this weekend. So I think I'm going to be the one hosting the after chat. Is that correct, Paul?
Yes. I'm afraid you're going to have to speak for both of us on the grand topic of whether or not lizard men do or don't eat people. but I'm eager to hear the results. So please do let me know.
Okay, I will, and I won't bias it in any way, shape, or form. So you can trust the results have not been polished by me for my own personal taste, such as it is. So everybody, don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we really hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.